On this edition for Sunday, May 3rd, cautious optimism as the country begins to ease lockdowns. The trickle-down impact of COVID-19 on Iowa farmers. And dancing to a beat of their own, next on PBS NewsHour Weekend.
PBS NewsHour Weekend is made possible by Bernard and Irene Schwartz, Sue and Edgar Wackenheim III, the Cheryl and Philip Milstein family, Rosalind P. Walter, Barbara Hope Zuckerberg, Charles Rosenblum. We try to live in the moment to not miss what's right in front of us. At Mutual of America, we believe taking care of tomorrow can help you make the most of today. Mutual of America Financial Group, retirement services and investments.
Consumer Cellular offers no-contract wireless plans that are designed to help you do more of the things you enjoy. Whether you're a talker, texter, browser, photographer, or a bit of everything, our U.S.-based customer service team is here to find a plan that fits you. To learn more, go to consumercellular.tv.
Additional support has been provided by and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.
Good evening, and thank you for joining us. It has now been more than 100 days since the first case of COVID-19 was reported in the United States. Weeks of stay-at-home orders have followed. The global pandemic is slowing, but not everywhere. In some places, restrictions are easing, but the debate over how and when to reopen continues. Let's get started with today's top news. As parts of the country and the economy begin to reopen, the Trump administration is taking a wait-and-see position on new financial aid. White House economic advisor Larry Kudlow said today the administration wants to see how the more than $3 trillion already allocated affect the country before authorizing more spending.
We're trying to get through this. We're trying to work through this. I don't want to rule in or out anything right now. We are in discussions internally and with leading members of Congress.
New York Governor Andrew Cuomo invited governors from nearby states to join him online at his daily news conference today, all focused on working together to meet their reopening and health care needs.
We're going to form a consortium with our seven Northeast partner states, which buy about $5 billion worth of equipment and supplies. That will then increase our market power when we're buying.
We can wait for the national stockpile. We can wait for that plane to land from China. Let's see what we can do ourselves. And as you point out, we're much stronger together. I wouldn't mind having some of that New York purchasing power. Thanks for sharing that with Connecticut going forward.
In other parts of the country, protesters demanding reopening of businesses and elimination of restrictions showed up again throughout the weekend. Some wore face masks, others did not, and called for governors to drop face mask requirements. In Ohio, Governor Mike DeWine rescinded his order mandating customers wear masks in stores.
People were not going to accept the government telling them what to do.
White House Coronavirus Response Coordinator Dr. Deborah Birx warned that the demonstrators she saw standing shoulder to shoulder at Michigan's state capitol on Thursday put many others at risk.
It's devastatingly worrisome to me personally, because if they go home and infect their grandmother or their grandfather who has a comorbid condition and they have a serious or an unfortunate outcome, they will feel guilty for the rest of our lives. So we need to protect each other at the same time we're voicing our discontent.
Money from the CARES Act has been distributed to many small businesses across the country. And while it has helped, some owners say it's time to get back to work. I recently spoke with Ben Heumann, owner of the Grand Cafe and High Rise Bakery in Jefferson City, Missouri. They've been delivery and pickup only since March, but tomorrow will open their doors and get back to business as cautiously as they can.
We obviously want to keep the social distancing guidelines of 6 feet apart. So we've taken tables out of both dining rooms in order to keep that space. The other guidelines were things like, you know, just limiting our capacity. We're probably looking at less than half of our capacity. We're gonna try to put a few extra tables outside. And then we will all be wearing protective equipment, masks and gloves while we're serving. You know, we're not going to require patrons to come in with those on, but we will be wearing those.
Ben, if you could describe your town a little bit and the economic impact that's been felt there.
I don't know the exact population of our town. It's in that 30 to 40,000 person range. It's not been good. There are a few, I know of a few people that do the same type of thing that I do that won't be reopening their doors. Some of them completely closed down. My businesses, I would say we've been doing 25% of our normal revenues.
And when you do open your doors on Monday, what are you expecting to see? Do you expect customers to come in, sit down, order a meal, and enjoy it by dining in?
We do. We've actually got some reservations, honestly. People want to get out. They want to get back to normal. It's a little bit different in our small town. We haven't seen the number of cases that they have in places like New York or Seattle, places like that.
And how do your staff feel? Are they all coming back?
For the most part, everybody, my main staff has been with me through the whole thing. We've been offering curbside and delivery and things like that. I guess everybody's a little apprehensive, but all that's really done is made us make sure that everybody is comfortable and that our employees are comfortable as well.
And why have you made the decision to open up on Monday? You don't have to. You could wait a little bit longer. Why now?
It's kind of a necessity. We can't sustain like this forever. In fact, I'd say we probably wouldn't want to try to do this for very much longer. It's tough. You know, it's a tough decision. We don't take it lightly for sure. We need to be open so that we can generate revenue, so that we can pay our taxes, so that the state can turn around and pay taxes to the federal government. I mean, that's how our economy works. We're kind of dipping our toe in and seeing where it takes us.
What do you say to critics that say you're just opening up too soon? You should wait longer.
Well, there's an argument there. There's an argument both ways. Our little town, we're spread out as it is, and we don't have the number of cases around us. So it makes us feel a little bit more comfortable. And there is a want from the public. People are ready to get out and get somewhat back to normal.
While parts of the United States and Europe are easing lockdowns, new coronavirus infections are still growing in some places. In Britain, hundreds of COVID-19 related deaths are still being reported each day. The UK's death toll, now more than 28,000, is nearing Italy's, once the epicenter of the outbreak in Europe. In Russia, the confirmed numbers of new COVID-19 cases surpassed 10,000 today, a stark jump from a week ago that officials said was partly due to increased testing. And in India, 2,600 new COVID-19 cases were reported today, a new daily record. Most of India's 1.3 billion people remain under lockdown restrictions that have been in place for more than 5 weeks, but less affected areas will have some restrictions eased this week. South Korea's military reported today that North Korean soldiers fired into a guard post along the two countries' border. South Korean soldiers responded with warning shots and issued a ceasefire broadcast. No casualties were reported on either side of the most heavily fortified border in the world. Following the incident, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said that the United States believes the initial shots fired were accidental. For more on the escalation between North and South Korea and the latest on the global pandemic, visit pbs.org/newshour. Former Vice President and Democratic candidate for President Joe Biden continues to face an allegation of sexual assault from Tara Reid, who worked for him 27 years ago in Biden's Senate office. Biden denied the allegations in television interviews over the past 2 days. Yesterday, the Associated Press published a story focused on Reid's recollection of a written report she says exists but does not possess. Alexandra Jaffe, one of the authors of that piece, joins us now from Washington, D.C. with the latest on this still developing story. A lot's happened since Joe Biden first publicly spoke about Reid's allegation and your AP report interviewing Reid. Since then, Reid has said some of the reporting in your interview isn't wholly accurate. Give us a quick TikTok of everything that's happened since your interview came out.
Sure. When I spoke with her, I tried to get sort of her to clarify whether she filed a full report and what the report said. And she told me that she filed only an intake form. So she basically just filled out a form with some basic information about herself and her office. And within that intake form, she did not use the words sexual harassment or assault. She said that she described an incident in which she was asked to serve drinks at a fundraiser because Joe Biden liked her legs and the retaliation that she experienced after that. But she repeatedly told me that she was too scared to use the words sexual harassment and was not that specific.
Yeah, that's something that she is sticking to at the moment. And this isn't the first time that AP's interviewed her. You also spoke to her back in 2019. Why is this the first time we're hearing about those interviews?
The April of 2019 interviews were conducted by two reporters, one of whom was part of our investigative team trying to vet these claims back when Tara first came forward and alleged that Joe Biden sexually harassed her. That was before she came forward with the allegation of assault. And we didn't end up publishing a story on sort of that exhaustive vetting process because we simply could not corroborate her claims.
Have you found anyone further that will corroborate these stories?
I can tell you, I've spoken with two people who spoke to me anonymously out of concern for their family, one of whom said that Tara expressed to her about a decade after the incident that she was sexually harassed by her boss in Washington. Another woman told me that Tara did indeed tell her at the time that she was sexually assaulted by her boss in Washington. But those were sort of anonymous sources, and without any written sort of proof, it's tough to say.
What's coming out of the Biden camp? What are you hearing from them? And what about those records from the University of Delaware? Will we see them anytime soon?
I think that this has brought renewed focus on Joe Biden's papers, which remain sort of locked away at University of Delaware. He has refused to call for them to be released. The university has said they're not going to release them until 2 years after Joe Biden exits public life. In speaking with the Biden campaign, you know, they're not weighing in on this. And they're staying quiet and letting sort of the vice president's comments on Friday speak for themselves.
So tell me, how are Republicans in the Trump administration responding to all of the noise that's going on about this story?
Republicans have seized on this as evidence that both Democrats and the media are treating this with hypocrisy. It gets at two major arguments for Republicans. One, that Democrats aren't consistent on this question of character. That's a central sort of focus and argument for Joe Biden, that he has a stronger character than Donald Trump. And two, Republicans frequently raise doubts about the media and questions about the media's coverage. And this really gets at that question as well.
Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Earlier this week, President Trump issued an executive order under the Defense Production Act classifying meat processing plants as critical infrastructure and ordering them to stay open. Still, many have been forced to close their doors due to COVID-19, impacting not just the meat producers, but the entire food chain, from farmers who raise hogs to grain farmers who help feed them. NewsHour Weekend's Melanie Saltzman has more.
This first group of pigs needs to be started to market in about 2 weeks.
Rob Stout is a fourth-generation hog farmer in southeast Iowa. He raises 4,000 pigs at any given time, selling about 11,000 each year.
It's a process that has started 9 months before we get them to the marketplace. You can't shut off the supply of pigs because those pigs were conceived a long, long time ago. We got caught in the pandemic. It's hitting us. Basically, going into savings or just borrowing more money at the bank to cover the cost.
Hog prices dropped by roughly half because of a sharp decline in demand due to restaurant closures and major disruptions in processing plants. Tyson Foods, one of the top pork producers in the U.S., warned the food supply chain is breaking and millions of pounds of meat will disappear from it.
I mean, a pig isn't useful to anyone unless it can be processed into pork.
Mike Postian is the president of the Iowa Pork Producers Association. He's also a hog farmer himself.
We're estimating that it's as many as 40,000 pigs per day are not going to market that normally would be. unfortunately, some farmers are going to be faced with the heartbreaking decision to perhaps have to euthanize some of their animals.
The coronavirus and the pandemic have really unleashed a cascade of difficult economic issues.
Neil Hamilton is the Emeritus Director of the Agricultural Law Center at Drake University.
Iowa agriculture came into this pandemic in a fairly precarious situation. We were suffering the consequences of a very difficult trade war that had been initiated by the United States that had dried up a number of our foreign markets. And a lot of farmers were really on the edge.
He also notes that producers in the food chain are all interconnected. So a hit to one part of the chain impacts everybody.
With meat in particular, you have not just the production of the animals, but you have the demand for what they eat. And all of those things are tied together. And so if there's less demand for livestock, there's also less demand for the feeds that feed them. It's a little bit like an accident on the freeway that kind of slows down traffic, and then the effects are rippled all the way back through the system.
It takes a lot of generations to build a farm, and it only takes one event like this to potentially lose a farm. So I hope that doesn't happen to me.
Sam Bennett, a sixth-generation farmer, is part of that system. He has 2,000 acres of crops, half corn and half soybeans.
Those soybeans are made into hog feed for the most part. And with the processing plants for hogs closing left and right, the demand for soy meal for hog feed is drastically cut.
Alfalfa was planted this spring at the same time I was planting oats.
NewsHour Weekend featured Sam Bennett last year. He was demonstrating for other farmers how to improve the health of their soil by diversifying the crops they grew. And he told us about his hopes for the future of his farm.
I'm not borrowing this land from my dad or my grandpa. I'm borrowing it from my kids and my grandkids. It's my responsibility to leave this land in better shape than I found it.
How have things been since we met?
Comparatively, things were good when we talked last. Things have gotten pretty tough recently, especially with the lack of demand for all of our products that we grow.
When we met Bennett last year, he was growing the very crop that he's now having trouble selling for a profit. Bennett says soybean prices dropped by 25% since the pandemic began. And the price of corn, tied to ethanol and energy demand, dropped about 25% as well. This is largely due to the fact that people have been sheltered in place and stopped driving.
Things don't look very good for the future. My cash flow for this year looks like $100,000 less than it would have been when I talked to my bankers this winter about securing loans for farming this year.
For now, Bennett is going to try to store his grains for as long as he can, hoping prices improve. But managing existing crops is only half the problem for Iowa farmers right now, because they just began planting next year's crop this week.
I've invested probably $400,000 just to plant a crop this year, and looks like right now we're gonna plant a crop for no profit.
There's an old saying that it takes 5 years to make up 1 year's losses, and that's probably could easily be true here.
Farmer Mike Helen grows corn and soybeans.
How much are you investing right now in next season's crop?
A tremendous amount of money and faith.
NewsHour Weekend also featured Helen last year when he described to us how hard it was to make a living as a farmer.
All of our costs keep going up. As a farmer, you never get a cost of living increase. You just have to be more efficient with the same machinery or same manpower, same hours.
Helen says he's lost as much as $100,000 in the last month alone. He says the pandemic could have long-term impacts on farming throughout Iowa.
You know, we're kind of looking towards retiring here in the next few years, and this is kind of putting a hold on a lot of retirement plans, which affects the younger generation too, because those are jobs that don't come available if people don't retire.
And in the meantime, this week, you just keep planting.
Keep working and take care of the things you can take care of and try not to worry about the things that you really don't have any control over. And weather and markets are two of those things.
Last summer, NewsHour Weekend spoke with New York City dancer and choreographer Reggie Regrock Gray about a new dance style he helped pioneer called Flexin. Now, almost a year later, New York's performance spaces have been shut down, but that doesn't mean Gray and his fellow dancers have stopped creating. NewsHour Weekend's Yvette Feliciano has more.
We love the stage. We love being in a place where it's full of people when everyone's around us. It's that give and receive feel, you know? We're just waiting for that moment again to happen so we can, you know, express our creative freedom within our movement.
Reggie Regrock Gray and his dance troupe, Dream Ring, may not be appearing on stage anytime soon, but they found a new venue online as part of a new digital art series, Up Close, presented by New York City Art Center, The Shed. Dream Ring's new work is called Revelation of Proverbs, a callback to the Bible verses Gray was reading when The Shed commissioned the piece.
Oddly enough, I was actually reading Proverbs. There's these short sayings of just wisdom. And then you think about Revelation, that's what it feels like right now, in the sense of your loneliness, right? Of you being quarantined in a place, and it's like, okay, well, I can't go outside because I'm either scared, I'm nervous, I don't want to get caught up, I might have a pre-existing condition. Like, no one knows what's going on. So like there's this spiritual awakening where it's like, okay, well, I have something here to create within, and how do we bring this out?
Were you guys able to meet at all? Was it all done online?
It definitely was all done online. The dancers come up with their own ideas. They come up with their way of doing things. And we got on a Zoom call. We just started talking about what's happening right now. What's it feel like? You know what I'm saying? Are you becoming more creative? Are you working out more? Like, what is happening in your life that's for the good and for the bad? What are your pros and cons? And they started to put it in their movement.
And what kind of environments are your dancers performing in?
Kitchens, living rooms, bathrooms, anywhere, I guess it feels like a story could be told. Everybody got the beards and the hair all messed up, but it's all good though. Like, it's liberating actually.
What are some of your thoughts about creating performance art during the time of social distancing?
It's nothing like performing live, because you really need that human exchange. You really want that feeling. Digitally, it feels like it takes the soul a bit, but it's still there. You know, we have to use what we have. We're actually using social media for what it's meant to be used for, right? Art is something to bring everyone together, and to not let art die out, we have to use our technology. We have to use our ways of connecting through the airwaves, through video, you know, to make something worthwhile so people can look at something and be inspired. So people can look at someone and say, hey, well, I can do that, or I can make this. You know, I don't have to just lay in my bed all day and be depressed or be scared about what's happening. Be creative, work out, do things you've never done before. Cook recipes. I've become a chef lately. I did not know I could cook this good until I started cooking, until this quarantine. I've really started like following recipes and cooking, and I'm like, oh, well, I can actually cook. Now is the time to get whatever you had out and just let it flourish.
And finally, another installment of our series, The New Normal, in which we feature your stories about how you're living now. Tonight, we head to California to meet an artist working in an unusual medium. NewsHour Weekend's Christopher Booker has details.
The artwork of Joanne Bolton is the byproduct of creativity and dog ownership.
Well, I started the artwork, I was looking around for something I might like to do when I retire, and we had a new dog, and I was walking around the neighborhood. I don't know what time of year it was, but seeds and everything was on the ground. I picked them up and thought, what can I do with these? These are free.
Free, and in the hands of Bolton, rather fantastic. Owls constructed from flower petals, ballerinas made of leaves, or cats with pine cone tails.
These are all, I have like 5 or 6 drawers of these leaves that have been pressed. So I can use them, you know, over and over again.
Bolton creates her images on top of a black velvet sheet and then takes a photograph. Right now, she says she's not sure what she wants to do with all the work. But at least during this time, our socially distanced time, she says she's keeping really busy.
My son kept saying, you can do this. You've got all this time. And I'm saying to him, it's no different from another day for me. I mean, I've definitely stepped up the making the things, but what is different is that it's given me more focus, actually more empathy. I mean, I hope it changes everybody for a long time, and I hope we we're able to stay isolated long enough to make it worthwhile.
That's all for this edition of PBS NewsHour Weekend. For the latest updates, visit pbs.org/newshour. I'm Karina Mitchell. Thanks for watching. Stay safe and have a great night.
PBS NewsHour Weekend is made possible by Bernard and Irene Schwartz, Sue and Edgar Wackenheim III, the Cheryl and Philip Milstein family, Rosalind P. Walter, Barbara Hope Zuckerberg, Charles Rosenblum. We try to live in the moment to not miss what's right in front of us. At Mutual of America, we believe taking care of tomorrow can help you make the most of today. Mutual of America Financial Group, retirement services and investments. Additional support has been provided by and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.